5. The Devil's Disciples. Money was the one means at Molly's disposal that might induce the indifferent white authorities to pursue a killer of Indians. After Lizzie died in July 1921, Molly's brother-in-law, Bill Smith, had presented his suspicions to authorities that she'd been slowly poisoned, but by August, they had still not looked into the case. Nor had any progress been made in the then 3-month-old probe of Anna's murder. To prod investigators, Molly's family issued a statement saying that because of the foulness of the crime and the dangers that exist to other people, they were offering a $2,000 cash reward for any information leading to the apprehension of those responsible. The Whitehorn family also offered a $2,500 reward to catch Charles's slayers. And William Hale, who campaigned for stamping out the criminal element from Osage County, promised his own reward to anyone who caught the killers, dead or alive. "We've got to stop this bloody business," he said. But the situation with law enforcement continued to deteriorate. The Oklahoma Attorney General soon charged Sheriff Frias with willfully failing to enforce the law by permitting bootlegging and gambling. Frias denied the allegations, and while the case awaited trial, these two powerful lawmen were pitted against each other. Given this turmoil, Hale announced that it was time to hire a private eye. During much of the 19th and early 20th centuries, private detective agencies had filled the vacuum left by decentralized, underfunded, incompetent, and corrupt sheriff and police departments. In literature and in the popular imagination, the all-seeing private eye, the gumshoe, the cinder dick, the sleuthhound, the shadow, displaced the crusading sheriff as the archetype of rough justice. He moved across the dangerous new frontiers of deep alleyways and roiling slums. His signature was not the smoking six-shooter. Instead, like Sherlock Holmes, he relied upon the startling powers of reason and deduction, the ability to observe what the Watsons of the world merely saw. He found order in a scramble of clues and, as one author put it, turned brutal crimes, the vestiges of the beast in man, into intellectual puzzles. Yet from the outset, the fascination with private detectives was mixed with aversion. They were untrained and unregulated and often had criminal records themselves. Beholden to paying clients, they were widely seen as surreptitious figures who burglarized people's secrets. The term to detect derived from the Latin verb to unroof. And because the devil, according to legend, allowed his henchmen to peer voyeuristically into houses by removing their roofs, detectives were known as the devil's disciples. In 1850, Alan Pinkerton founded the first American private detective agency. In advertisements, the company's motto, "We never sleep," was inscribed under a large, unblinking, Masonic-like eye, which gave rise to the term private eye. In a manual of general principles and rules that served as a blueprint for the industry, Pinkerton admitted that the detective must at times depart from the strict line of truth and resort to deception. Yet even many people who despised the profession deemed it a necessary evil. As one private eye put it, he might be a miserable snake, but he was also the silent, secret, and effective avenger of the outraged majesty of the law when everything else fails. Hale recruited a brooding private detective from Kansas City who went by the name of Pike. To preserve his cover, Pike, who smoked a corncob pipe and had a smudge of a mustache, met Hale at a concealed spot near Whizbang. Civic leaders like Hale considered the name Whizbang undignified and instead called the town Denoya, after a prominent Osage family. As smoke from the oil fields melted into the sky, Hale conferred with Pike. Then Pike slipped away to pursue his investigation. At the direction of Molly and her family, Anna's estate also hired private detectives. The estate was being administered by Scott Mathis, the Big Hill Trading Company owner who had long managed the financial affairs for Anna and Lizzie as a guardian. The U.S. government, contending that many Osage were unable to handle their money, had required the Office of Indian Affairs to determine which members of the tribe it considered capable of managing their trust funds. Over the tribe's vehement objections, many Osage, including Lizzie and Anna, were deemed incompetent and were forced to have a local white guardian overseeing and authorizing all of their spending, down to the toothpaste they purchased at the corner store. One Osage who had served in World War I complained, "I fought in France for this country, and yet I am not allowed even to sign my own checks." The guardians were usually drawn from the ranks of the most prominent white citizens in Osage County. Mathis put together a team of private eyes, as did the estate for Whitehorn. The private detectives investigating the Osage deaths had often worked for the William J. Burns International Detective Agency before venturing out on their own. Burns, a former Secret Service agent, had succeeded Pinkerton as the world's most celebrated private eye. A short, stout man with a luxuriant mustache and a shock of red hair, Burns had once aspired to be an actor, and he cultivated a mystique in part by writing pulp detective stories about his cases. In one such book, he declared, "My name is William J. Burns, and my address is New York, London, Paris, Montreal, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, New Orleans, Boston, Philadelphia, Cleveland, and wherever else a law-abiding citizen may find need of men who know how to go quietly about throwing out of ambush a hidden assassin or drawing from cover criminals who prey upon those who walk straight." Though dubbed a front-page detective for his incessant self-promotion, he had an impressive track record, including catching those responsible for the 1910 bombing of the headquarters of the Los Angeles Times, which killed 20 people. The New York Times called Burns perhaps the only really great detective, the only detective of genius whom this country has produced. And Sir Arthur Conan Doyle gave him the moniker he longed for, America's Sherlock Holmes. Unlike Sherlock Holmes, though, Burns had rigged juries and allegedly kidnapped a suspect, and he routinely used the sordid techniques of imperial spies. After being caught breaking into a New York law office in an attempt to steal evidence, he said that such methods were sometimes needed to prove a conspiracy and that such lines had been crossed 1,000 times by private investigators. Burns perfectly embodied the new profession. That summer, the team of operatives hired by Mathis began to infiltrate Osage County. Each agent identified himself in his daily reports only by a coded number. At the outset, operative number 10 asked Mathis, who'd been a juror on the inquest, to show him the crime scene. "Mathis and myself drove out to the place where the body was found," number 10 wrote. One of the investigators spoke to Anna's main servant. She revealed that after the body was found, she'd obtained a set of Anna's keys and had gone, with Anna's sister Rita Smith, to Anna's house. Incredibly, no one from the sheriff's office had searched the place yet. The women eased open the door and stepped through the silence. They could see Anna's jewelry and blankets and pictures, the accumulated treasures of her life now resembling the ruins of a lost city. The servant who had helped dress Anna the day she disappeared recalled, "Everything was just as we left it, except for one thing." Anna's alligator purse, which she had taken to Molly's luncheon, was now lying on the floor, the servant said, with everything torn out of it. Nothing else in the house appeared to have been stolen, and the presence of the bag indicated that Anna had likely returned to her house at some point after the luncheon. Molly's brother-in-law, Brian, seemed to be telling the truth about having brought her home. But had he taken her back out? Or had she gone away with someone else? Number 10 turned to another potentially rich vein of clues, the records of Anna's incoming and outgoing telephone calls. In those days, phone calls were manually patched through by an operator at a switchboard, with long-distance calls often relayed through multiple switchboards. These operators frequently kept a written record of the calls. According to the log of a Fairfax operator, at about 8:30 on the night Anna disappeared, someone had rung her house from a phone belonging to a business in Ralston, a town 6 miles southwest of Greyhorse. The records showed that someone, presumably Anna, had picked up. That meant that Anna was likely still in her house at 8:30, further evidence that Brian had been truthful about taking her home. The private detective, sensing that he was on the verge of a breakthrough, hurried to the Ralston business where the call originated. The proprietor insisted that he hadn't called Anna's house and that nobody else would have been allowed to make a long-distance call from his phone. Bolstering his claims, no Ralston operator had a record of the call being patched through to the Fairfax operator. "This call seems a mystery," Number 10 wrote. He suspected that the Ralston number was really a blind, that an operator had been paid to destroy the original log ticket, which revealed the true source of the call. Someone, it seemed, was covering his or her tracks. Number 10 wanted to look closely at Oda Brown. "General suspicion points toward the divorced husband," he wrote. But it was getting late, and he finished his report saying, "Discontinued on case, 11 p.m. A week later, another operative from the team, number 46, was sent to locate Brown in Ponca City, 25 miles northwest of Greyhorse. A savage storm blew across the prairie and turned the streets into rivers of mud, so the private detective didn't arrive in Ponca City until dark, only to discover that Brown wasn't there. He was said to be visiting Perry, Oklahoma, where his father lived. The next day, number 46 took a train south to Perry, but Brown wasn't there either. He was now said to be in Pawnee County. "Consequently, I left Perry on the first train," number 46 wrote in his report. This was what Sherlock Holmes' stories left out, the tedium of real detective work, the false leads and the dead ends. Back and forth, number 46 went until, in Pawnee County, he spied a slender, cigarette-smoking, shifty-looking man with rust-colored hair and flat, gray eyes. Oda Brown. He was with a Pawnee woman, whom he'd reportedly married after Anna's death. Number 46 stayed close, shadowing them. One day, number 46 approached Brown, trying to befriend him. The Pinkerton manual advised, the watchful detective will seize the criminal in his weakest moments and force from him, by his sympathy and the confidence which the criminal has in him, the secret which devours him. Number 46 wormed his way deeper into Brown's confidence. When Brown mentioned that his ex-wife had been murdered, Number 46 tried to elicit from him where he'd been at the time of her death. Brown, perhaps suspecting his new friend was a professional snoop, said that he'd been away with another woman, though he wouldn't disclose the location. Number 46 studied Brown intently. According to the manual, a criminal's secret becomes an enemy within him and weakens the whole fortress of his strength. But Brown didn't appear at all nervous. While Number 46 was working on Brown, another operative, Number 28, learned a seemingly vital secret from a young Kaw Indian woman who lived near the western border of Osage County. In a signed statement, the woman claimed that Rose Osage, an Indian in Fairfax, had admitted to her that she'd killed Anna after Anna had tried to seduce her boyfriend, Joe Allen. Rose said that while the three were riding in a car, she'd shot her on the top of her head, then, with Joe's help, dumped the body by Three Mile Creek. Rose's clothes got spattered with Anna's blood, the story went, so she took them off and discarded them in the creek. It was a grim tale, but Operative Number 28 was buoyed by the discovery. In his daily report, he said that he'd spent hours with Mathis and Sheriff Frias, whose trial was still pending, pursuing this clue that seems to be a lead on the case. The private detectives, though, struggled to corroborate the informant's story. No one had spotted Anna with Rose or Joe, nor were any clothes found in the stream by the body. Was it possible that the informant was simply lying to get the reward? Sheriff Frias, his flesh unfolding from his voluminous neck and chest, urged the private detectives to discount Rose and her boyfriend as suspects. Then he offered a counter-rumor. Two hard-boiled characters from the oil camps had purportedly been seen with Anna shortly before her death, and had afterwards skipped town. The private detectives agreed to look into the sheriff's story. But concerning the allegations against Rose, Number 28 vowed, "We are going to follow out this theory." The private detectives shared what they knew with Bill Smith, Molly's brother-in-law, who was still conducting his own investigation. The 29-year-old Smith had been a horse thief before attaching himself to an Osage fortune. First by marrying Molly's sister Minnie, and then, only months after Minnie's death from the mysterious wasting illness in 1918, by wedding Molly's sister Rita. On more than one occasion when Bill drank, he'd raised his hand to Rita. A servant later recalled that after one row between Bill and Rita, she came out kind of bruised up. Bill told the servant, "That was the only way to get along with them squaws." Rita often threatened to leave him, but she never did. Rita had a keen mind, yet those close to her thought that her judgment was impaired by what one person described as a love that was truly blind. Molly had her doubts about Bill. Had he in some way been responsible for Minnie's death? Hale made it clear that he didn't trust Bill either, and at least one local attorney speculated that Bill was prostituting the sacred bond of marriage for sordid gain. But since Anna's murder, Bill had, by all appearances, vigorously sought to discover who the culprit was. When Bill learned that a tailor in town might have information, he went with a private detective to ask him questions, only to find that he was spreading the now familiar rumor that Rose Osage had killed Anna in a fury of jealousy. Desperate for a break, the private detectives decided to install a listening device to eavesdrop on Rose and her boyfriend. At the time, statutes governing electronic surveillance were nebulous, and Burns was an avid user of a dictograph, a primitive listening device that could be concealed in anything from a clock to a chandelier. Burns was the first American to see the immense possibilities of the instrument in detective work, the Literary Digest reported in 1912. He is so enamored with it that he always carries one in his pocket. Just as Alan Pinkerton in the 19th century was known as the eye, Burns in the 20th century had become the ear. The detectives, hiding in another room, began listening to the staticky voices of Rose and her boyfriend through earphones. But, as is so often the case with surveillance, the rush of excitement gave way to the tediousness of other people's inner lives, and the private detectives eventually stopped bothering to jot down the innocuous details that they overheard. Using more conventional means, however, the private detectives made a startling discovery. The cab driver who'd taken Anna to Molly's house on the day she vanished told them that Anna had asked him to stop first at the cemetery in Greyhorse. She had climbed out and stumbled through the stones until she paused by her father's tomb. For a moment, she stood near the spot where she too would soon be buried, as if offering a morning prayer to herself. Then she returned to the car and asked the driver to send someone to bring flowers to her father's tomb. She wanted his grave to always be pretty. While they continued to Molly's house, Anna leaned toward the driver. He could smell her liquored breath as she divulged a secret. She was going to have a little baby.
"My goodness, no," he replied.
"I am," she said.
"Is that so?"
"Yes." Detectives later confirmed the story with two people close to Anna. She had also confided to them the news of her pregnancy, yet no one knew who the father was. One day that summer, a stranger with a chaplain-esque mustache showed up in Greyhorse to offer his assistance to the private eyes. The man, who was armed with a .44-caliber snub-nosed English bulldog, was named A.W. Comstock, and he was a local attorney and the guardian of several Osage Indians. Some locals thought that Comstock, with his aquiline nose and tan complexion, might be part American Indian, an impression that he did little to discourage as he built up his legal practice. The fact he represented himself to be an Indian would make him get along pretty well with the Indians, wouldn't it? Another lawyer skeptically remarked. William Burns had once investigated Comstock for allegedly assisting an oil company in a scheme to bribe the Osage Tribal Council for a favorable lease, but the charge was never proven. Given Comstock's numerous contacts among the Osage, the private eyes now took him up on his offer to help. While the detectives were trying to establish a connection between the slayings of Charles Whitehorn and Anna Brown, Comstock passed on tidbits that he collected from his network of informants. There was chatter that Whitehorn's widow, Hattie, had coveted her husband's money, chatter that she'd been jealous of his relationship with another woman. Was it possible that this woman was Anna Brown? Such a hypothesis led to the next logical question. Was Whitehorn the father of her baby? The detectives began to follow Hattie Whitehorn around the clock, relishing being able to see without being seen. Operatives shadowed Mrs. Whitehorn to Oklahoma City from Pawhuska, left Oklahoma City with Mrs. Whitehorn for Guthrie, trailed Mrs. Whitehorn, Tulsa, to Pawhuska. But there were no developments. By February 1922, 9 months after the murders of Whitehorn and Anna Brown, the investigations into the cases seemed to have reached a permanent impasse. Pike, the detective Hale had enlisted, had moved on. Sheriff Frias was also no longer leading the investigation. That February, he was expelled from office after a jury had found him guilty of failing to enforce the law. Then, on a frigid night that month, William Stepson, a 29-year-old Osage Champion steer roper, received a call that prompted him to leave his house in Fairfax. He returned home to his wife and two children several hours later, visibly ill. Stepson had always been in remarkable shape, but within hours, he was dead. Authorities, upon examining the body, believed that someone he met during his excursion had slipped him a dose of poison, possibly strychnine, a bitter white alkaloid that, according to a 19th-century medical treatise, was endowed with more destructive energy than virtually any other poison. The treatise described how a lab animal injected with strychnine becomes agitated and trembles, and is then seized with stiffness and starting of the limbs, adding, "These symptoms increase till at length it is attacked with a fit of violent general spasm in which the head is bent back, the spine stiffened, the limbs extended and rigid, and the respiration checked by the fixing of the chest." Stepson's final hours would have been a hideous torment, his muscles convulsing as if he were being jolted with electricity, his neck craning and his jaw tightening, his lungs constricting as he tried to breathe, until at last he suffocated. By the time of Stepson's death, scientists had devised numerous tools to detect poison in a corpse. A sample of tissue could be extracted from the body and tested for the presence of an array of toxic substances, from strychnine to arsenic. Yet in much of the country, these forensic methods were applied even less consistently than fingerprint and ballistic techniques. In 1928, a survey by the National Research Council concluded that the coroner in most counties of the United States was an untrained and unskilled individual and had a small staff of mediocre ability and with inadequate equipment. In places like Osage County, where there was no coroner trained in forensics and no crime laboratory, poisoning was a perfect way to commit murder. Poisons were abundantly available in products found on the shelves of apothecaries and grocery stores, and unlike a gunshot, they could be administered without a sound. And the symptoms of many toxic substances mimicked natural ailments. The nausea and diarrhea of cholera, or the seizure of a heart attack. During Prohibition, there were so many accidental deaths caused from wood alcohol and other toxic brews of bootleg whiskey that a killer could also spike a person's glass of moonshine without ever arousing suspicions. On March 26, 1922, less than a month after Stepson's death, an Osage woman died of a suspected poisoning. Once again, no thorough toxicology exam was performed. Then, on July 28, Joe Bates, an Osage man in his 30s, obtained from a stranger some whiskey, and after taking a sip, he began frothing at the mouth before collapsing.
He, too, had died of what authorities described as some strange poison. He left behind a wife and 6 children. That August, as the number of suspicious deaths continued to climb, many Osage prevailed upon Barney McBride, a wealthy 55-year-old white oil man, to go to Washington, D.C. and ask federal authorities to investigate. McBride had been married to a Creek Indian, now deceased, and was raising his stepdaughter. He had taken a strong interest in Indian affairs in Oklahoma, and he was trusted by the Osage. A reporter described him as a kind-hearted, white-haired man. Given that he also knew many officials in Washington, he was considered an ideal messenger. When McBride checked into a rooming house in the Capitol, he found a telegram from an associate waiting for him. "Be careful," it said. McBride carried with him a Bible and a .45-caliber revolver. In the evening, he stopped at the Elks Club to play billiards. When he headed outside, someone seized him and tied a burlap sack tightly over his head. The next morning, McBride's body was found in a culvert in Maryland. He had been stabbed more than 20 times. His skull had been beaten in, and he had been stripped naked, except for his socks and shoes, in one of which had been left a card with his name. The forensic evidence suggested that there had been more than one assailant, and authorities suspected that his killers had shadowed him from Oklahoma. News of the murder quickly reached Molly and her family. The killing, which the Washington Post called the most brutal in crime annals in the district, appeared to be more than simply a murder. It had the hallmarks of a message, a warning. In a headline, the Post noted what seemed to be increasingly clear: conspiracy believed to kill rich Indians.